Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Usually our calls last about an hour, but tonight I have so much material, I guarantee we're going to go over an hour. I'll start with a clinical pearl and then move into case studies and questions that have been submitted by you. Tonight we have two case studies and a lot of questions. So discussing patients, just be mindful of patient privacy and don't disclose any identifying information if you're asking about a patient. Just for reference, all of you are currently muted. And as I go through each section of the talk, I will pause and open up for questions on the topic I've just completed. And you can unmute yourself by pressing *7. And then we can have discussion or question and answers, and do introduce yourself. I want to say that tonight is the 3-year anniversary of Grand Rounds Calls. The very first Grand Rounds call was in April of 2017, and it's April 2020 now. So we have a really huge library of advanced topics in the form of clinical pearls. We have many case studies and lots of Q&A on specific questions you've all asked, and lots of reference articles. So over this 3-year period, our resource library has become very rich, and I hope that you take advantage of it. We are going to work on it and develop a index so that it's easier for you to find information. There is a guide to all of the topics of the clinical pearls and all of the case studies. So if you're looking for a particular topic, or you're looking for a case study on breast cancer or prostate cancer, you can use those indexes that are there right now. If you have not been paying attention to our newsletters, this is the last Grand Rounds call for probably till towards the end of the year. I'm taking a sabbatical, and I know that everyone in the course has not gone through every single Grand Rounds call that is in the library, so there's plenty for you to take advantage of. And I really welcome your feedback on if you'd like the course or these calls to take a different kind of a format. I'm going to sort of rethink how the course is taught and how mentoring is delivered. So if you have a wish list or thoughts about it, go ahead and send an email to support@aiore.com, and we'll take your feedback with high value. Now tonight, the clinical pearl is on COVID-19 and cancer patients, how to care for our most vulnerable patients. And although this isn't specifically a talk on oncology, I think given what's going on in the world, this is kind of front burner, top of mind for everyone. So I wanted to point some things out where there's an intersection between COVID-19 and cancer and the needs of cancer patients. And then we have a breast cancer study, case study, and a Hodgkin's lymphoma case study, and a number of questions. So I'll jump right into the COVID-19 and cancer clinical pearl lecture. There are over 40 slides in this lecture. I usually use about 15 or 20 slides to teach the clinical pearls. So I developed this document. I have over 200 slides on this topic. I developed this document for you to be also a reference document so that you can see how I dose and put support plans together for patients at risk or patients in recovery, and how to keep people safe if they're developing the acute infection. Now, let's just for terminology's sake, remember that COVID-19 is the name of the syndrome or the illness, and SARS-CoV-2 is the name of the virus that causes this disease or syndrome. I'm just going to use COVID-19 to refer to both for the ease of language during the talk, but it's important to understand that difference, that the organism itself is SARS-CoV-2. It's a coronavirus in the SARS family. And you should have all received an email with links to this slide deck so you can follow along, and also the case studies. Now, I wholeheartedly recommend that patients follow CDC prevention guidelines, but I've also added some things for my patients because we're really interested in them engaging in a high level of self-care. And so I've added into the list from the CDC of social isolation and observing physical distance, wearing a mask, practicing hand washing and mindful hygiene, but I've added to make sure that patients get enough sleep, exercise, nourishing diet, proper hydration, and that they tend to stress management and relaxation, and that they find a way to stay connected to others. I think all of those things are very important during this shelter-in-place period and the period where the virus is more active and we don't have much herd immunity. I also want to bring your attention to a very wonderful thermometer that, if you're going to recommend a thermometer for a patient to use to monitor themselves, their family, their employees, Kinsa Quick Care Smart Digital Thermometer, that's KINSA. It actually is linked to an app that creates heat maps, and it can be used by health departments to track where they're likely to be outbreaks. And so it adds to a public health database if you use this app. And I think one of the things that we can do, especially as we attempt to be under less strict stay-at-home guidelines and tiptoe out into the world eventually, that monitoring temperature is a good way to, in a fairly low-tech way, to be monitoring people that we do or don't invite into our offices or our homes, et cetera, and to monitor ourselves and our families. So I highly recommend that thermometer because it really provides a service that can identify where the virus may be spreading or where there may be a hotspot for an outbreak that might be invisible because carriers are asymptomatic. Now, slide number 5. I wanted to give you a picture of what the blood work looks like in these patients who are moving into physiologic danger and decline, and some of these patients will move into organ failure and mortality. And I put this slide here because these are many markers that we follow in the cancer terrain, in the tumor microenvironment. And some of these biomarkers are the same biomarkers that we see in a cancer patient who is also having progressive life-threatening disease. And so this is what it looks like when physiology is failing and in trouble. Now, our most high-risk patients are those with hypertension and cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, elders. Men seem to be at a higher risk because the ACE2 receptor in the lung is a binding site for the virus, and the ACE2 receptor is on the X chromosome, and men only have one X chromosome, where women have two, and there seems to be a hypothesis that might be the reason men are more vulnerable. In China, the demographics and the statistics we've found don't really completely apply to our American population. Most men in China are smokers, so that might be why in China men are more at risk. And in America, our epidemic of diabetes and obesity is a very big risk factor for COVID-19 infection and doing poorly, being at higher risk for progression. So we want to be mindful of our population, although elders are most at risk because as we age, we have comorbid health conditions that compromise us, but also because immunity is less robust as we age. And often elders have poor nutritional status. But in America, unlike in China, quite a number of cases are found in the between 40 and 60 age group as well. So we can't just be thinking about our elders. It may be that younger people have less symptoms. We don't really know that yet. But let's just take a look briefly at these biomarkers. In these patients, their pulse rate will go over 125. That's kind of the red flag moment. That is generally due to hypoxia. And it may also be due to damage to the myocardium, which this syndrome causes. A lot of inflammatory markers, such as IL-6, ferritin, CRP, are elevated. LDH becomes elevated. The liver enzymes become elevated. You see a drop in lymphocytes and leukocytes, basophils, eosinophils, monocytes, and all many categories of T cells, the helper, suppressor, and regulatory cells. So this is a system that is not able any longer to respond or who has been damaged by the nature of this syndrome. Also, you see thrombocytopenia, but you also see hypercoagulation in these patients. Some patients will complain of pain in their lower extremities or develop thromboembolisms, both in their lower extremities and pulmonary embolisms. And so this is a risk factor, but that's a fact of hyper inflammation as well. This, the inflammatory phase of this syndrome, spoken of as a cytokine storm, damages the lungs, the kidneys, the liver, and the myocardium, and the brain. And so patients can go into organ failure, but those patients that survive, there is no model right now in conventional medicine for taking care of patients who have survived COVID-19 and come out of it. And that includes people who have sheltered at home and ridden out their viral journey at home. These patients often have persistent lung inflammation and damage to the alveoli in the lungs. And so I think our medicine, we really should be thinking about what we're going to do to help these patients. These patients are, of course, during their infection, they're susceptible to a secondary bacterial infection, acute respiratory distress syndrome, and septic shock. And once you get in that territory, then risk of mortality is very high. So we know that patients who already have higher baseline levels of inflammation are going to be more at risk for going into this increased upregulation of immune inflammation. And these are the most at-risk patients. So if you have a patient already who is has autoimmune disease or some kind of other chronic inflammation, they're going to be more at risk for the serious complications of this syndrome. Now, on slide number 6, I'm going to give you a framework of thinking about kind of the phases of this. And I've been following the research that's been coming out of China. And number one, 90% of all patients in China also received Chinese herbal medicine. And the clinicians there have taken very detailed and kept meticulous records and are starting to publish some of what they observed with different herbal formulas. There were formulas given to nurses and doctors and care providers to prevent them from getting infections. And in two institutions, those clinicians that took certain herbal formulas did not contract the illness. And there are formulas that are being used in prevention. And so in the Chinese model, they think of it in these four phases. And I think this is a good way for us to think about it because it helps guide our choices of intervention. So certainly the big phase is prevention. We want to make sure people have robust immunity and good resistance to viral infection. And in Chinese medicine, the use of tonics to really support the stress response and support digestion and good absorption of nutrients are key to preparing someone to have a robust immune system. And then on top of that, they're giving antiviral formulas to patients. But that's kind of the model in China. Then there are those patients who have been exposed. They may have early mild symptoms. They need more support for enhancing their immunity and promoting viral resistance. But then a patient can actually go into the active phase of the disease where the infection is really prominent. And this is a very dangerous stage. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding what we should be doing for these patients. At this juncture, I like to remove the immune stimulants, things that might potentially increase an upregulation of inflammation and feed a cytokine storm. So I'll go over how I do that so that patients don't get into so much trouble and that we have ways to mitigate excessive inflammation. And then this larger group of people recovered, remember 80% of all patients who contract this infection will recover from it, and most of them will have some kind of damage. And so there's no one is addressing that. So being in a health model ourselves, we should address it. Now on slide number 7, I've just given you a list of the things I think are the big levers in terms of a materia medica and a toolbox and things that have good studies to support the rationale of using them. This is by no means a comprehensive list. And in this mini lecture overview, I am not going to discuss all of these things, but I want you to have this list because these are things to look into and be knowledgeable about if you're working with these patients. And so I'm going to speak to some of them, but there are nutraceuticals, there are botanicals and phytochemicals, and then there are the polysaccharides and beta-glucans, and also probiotics. So I'm going to take a few from each of those categories and talk about them a little bit. But I think that this is a reliable list of things you can build a treatment plan out of for patients with these challenges. And many of these things are already in the protocols we use in the OutSmart Cancer System for our patients who have cancer in their lives or are cancer survivors. Slide number 8 kind of shows my thinking about phase 1, the prevention phase, we're really supporting immunity and enhancing viral resistance. On the left-hand side, you'll see the supplements that I recommend in the doses. And then on the right-hand side, you'll see an increase in dosing and viral for those people who have had viral exposure, and we know they're in the early stages of the infection. So the primary components I'm using are melatonin, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, some kind of medicinal mushroom, something polysaccharide rich, astragalus, and then I'm using Chinese herbs with all my patients. And in these slides, I gave you ready-made formulas that are easy to get. There's a company called Health Concerns that I like very much, and they have some fantastic formulas that apply to this patient population, and I'll show you those formulas on a slide as well. On the right-hand side, I switch out the Chinese formulas that are more immune-boosting for very strong antiviral herbs. During the prevention phase, I use antiviral herbs, and these formulas have antiviral herbs in them, but I make that the emphasis once we know someone's had an exposure. And then in the phase where someone's actually in an active infection, and this really could be a lot of our patients who never get hospitalized, never get into that much trouble, but are at home, and need some tools. So I stop the immune tonics and immune stimulants because there is a danger that they will increase the cytokine storm and this hyper upregulation of immune response. So I pull out the astragalus, the echinacea, the medicinal mushrooms, and anything rich in polysaccharides and beta-glucans. Now, that may be too extreme, but I think very much beginner's mind, all of us, with how to manage this, and also following what they're doing in China. And so that's where my ideas come from. And in slide number 10, I show you then what it looks like to have a protocol that enhances viral resistance and then more emphasizes inflammation control, so that these patients don't get into so much trouble, and more support for the lungs. And so I introduce into these protocols quercetin, N-acetylcysteine, resveratrol, American ginseng, and continue the Health Concerns Clear Heat formula, which are very potent antivirals. And I'm going to show you these formulas. But that's just sort of how I'm thinking about it and what I'm doing with patients. And then on slide number 11, you'll see how I'm thinking about what we need to address in recovery and repair, repletion and restoration, and the things we really should be thinking about. And I have a body of information of what they're doing in China, and I need to put that together for you, but I don't have it all. But really, we need to think these patients, their HPA axis has been exhausted, and they're very fatigued and often feel very weak. They have pulmonary damage and fibrosis, myocardial damage and fibrosis, hepatic damage and fibrosis, renal damage and fibrosis. They generally have lost muscle mass. Many have compromised cognitive function, especially if they have been on a ventilator. And many have disrupted GI function. Remember, the virus is found in the stool. And people have been hospitalized and been on ventilators have some PTSD as well. So I think that acupuncture is a very good tool throughout every phase of this. And then the most nourishing things and teaching people self-care and how to develop more resilience and vagal and parasympathetic balancing, things like that, along with therapeutic foods and tonic herbs and things, getting out in nature, et cetera. So I want to just go through some of the nutraceuticals. I have a lot of details on these slides, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to read them to you, but I want you to use this. You can use this as a little reference and handbook. Now, very important is vitamin A is retinoic acid. We are not talking about beta carotene. We are talking about vitamin A. And vitamin A is incredibly important in regulating and modulating both the innate and adaptive immune systems and T-cell function and that balance between Th1 and Th2 and influence on dendritic cells and developing an immune memory. But of course, one of our goals also is to really have healthy mucosal epithelial barriers. That's a principle in treatment plans for these patients. So vitamin A is very important there. And vitamin A also has an impact on inflammatory responses and cytokines. So it is a multitasker that fits a lot of our niches. Now, interestingly, in patients with vitamin A deficiencies, there are actually histopathological changes in lung tissue that impair lung physiology and predispose patients to lung dysfunction and respiratory disease. And so vitamin A then can really be protective in creating more healthy lung tissue and physiology. And in underdeveloped countries, children are given vitamin A by the World Health Association to protect them, because there's a lot of vitamin A deficiency in children, and so their lungs don't develop normally. So there was one study I found showing that retinoic acid, vitamin A, promotes alveolar regeneration in mice. So I couldn't find any human studies in that, but that's hopeful. So it's just an overview of vitamin A. The dosing is in the slides where I give you the protocols. Now, vitamin C, of course, we think of vitamin C being able to be used as a preventive as well as treatment intervention for respiratory and systemic infections. And really to get good blood levels, I think you have to supplement, and for people who eat a modern diet. Now, vitamin C is so protective in so many ways because it really protects the tissue from the oxidative stress and helps tissue repair. And so that's very important. Of course, it has a direct impact on neutrophils and phagocytosis and the sort of the macrophages and how the cleanup and apoptosis of dead cells happens. And so it's very important. But I think in this context where tissue is being damaged by oxidative stress, it's very important. In China, they are doing IV vitamin C in the hospital on patients, and those patients did better. And there are some papers coming out of China on that. So we can think of both oral and intravenous vitamin C potentially for these patients. There's a great paper I've referenced here called Vitamin C and Immune Function, really great paper. So and there's a list of all the references from these slides in the notes for this call as well. Vitamin D3, of course, is very important, cholecalciferol. Vitamin D being very, very powerful in inhibiting pulmonary inflammatory responses and enhancing defense mechanisms of the innate immune system to respiratory pathogens. And during the SARS epidemic in Canada, the Canadian Health Department decided every Canadian citizen should take vitamin D during the SARS epidemic for this reason. And there is an inverse relationship between vitamin D concentration in the serum and acute respiratory tract infections. So in general, during cold and flu season, in our vulnerable patients, kids in elementary school and kindergarten and daycare, elders and group homes should all be taking vitamin D so that they really enhance their immunity, their inflammation control, and epithelial repair. And there's a really nice slide showing all the functions of vitamin D, including its impact on virus. It does decrease viral replication and the capacity of viruses to be able to infect and invade tissue, and protects the epithelium as well. So it has this impact on the cytokines and chemokines. So very important. For those elders, you know, like the parents of my friends and patients who aren't interested in taking supplements, I say just try to get them to take some vitamin D and some zinc, at least, if nothing else, and a little C. Now, zinc is incredibly important, and there are a number of really wonderful published papers on zinc as an antiviral in the immune system. It's very, very important in antiviral immunity. It has an impact on natural killer cells, lymphocytes, macrophages, and the antibody response. And there's one paper titled The Role of Zinc in Antiviral Immunity, and another paper, Nutritional Modulation of Immune Function, Analysis of Evidence, Mechanisms, and Clinical Relevance, that talks about many nutrients, including zinc. But remember, zinc is really part of the antiviral response. It's very important. Now melatonin is something that typically we don't think about in the infection setting. And melatonin is not a direct antiviral, but remember, it's a super antioxidant. And in patients who have active infection, a lot of the damage is occurring from oxidative stress. So having a super antioxidant is very useful. And of course, vitamin A and C fall into that category as well. But the melatonin is really interesting because it's a modulator of immune response, and it can upregulate and downregulate. But the organ failure and organ damage are from oxidative stress, and melatonin is protective to the nephron, the myocardium, and the hepatocytes in this context. So I think that's really important. And of course, it's a neuroantioxidant. So for those patients whose brains are being affected by all this, it would be protective as well. So we could just think of a melatonin like a buffer for the immune system, and that has varied and complex effects on the immune system. And it will impact many inflammatory cytokines, NF-kappa-B, TNF-alpha, and interferon, IL-1, IL-6, the matrix metalloproteinases, and the activity of macrophages and lymphocytes, nitric oxide. And so think of it as a super antioxidant and a super anti-inflammatory. But what's really interesting is that could be an immunostimulant and really make the early immune response more effective against viruses and parasites. But if there's a chronic upregulation of the immune system, melatonin also seems to exert some negative regulation and have an anti-inflammatory effect. So we like things like that. So I want to just bring your attention to the fact that every single supplement I have mentioned so far is part of our Outsmite cancer treatment plans. And so many of our patients are already on all of these things. So you want to take a look at what's in your treatment plans for your cancer patients and cancer survivors. many or most or all of these things will be in there already, so you can reassure patients that they also have some viral resistance because of those supplements. And then just kind of look at the dosing and make sure patients are in good compliance with what you have recommended to them. And then you might, if you don't have zinc in the plan, you might want to put it in there. So I think it's a good opportunity for reevaluation, especially for the most vulnerable patients. Probiotics, of course, are very important here because of their impact on innate and adaptive immunity, their impact on mucosal integrity, and their impact on inflammatory cytokines. So we want to maintain a good, healthy gut microbiome. But what's really interesting is there's a microbiome in the nasal passageways and in the respiratory passageways and in the lungs. And there is crosstalk between the lung microbiome and the gut microbiome. And there are influences that change the capacity of the lung microbiome to be healthy and resist infection. So again, we've come once, circle back to the importance of probiotics on systemic immune function and systemic inflammation. There's a really nice paper here, the prospective study of probiotic supplementation results in immune stimulation and improvement of upper respiratory infections. Really good paper. Okay, so those are like the core nutraceuticals that I put in. Could you put in other things? Yes, you could put in lots of other things, but those I think must be in the treatment plan. And for our patients, they should already, all of those things be in their treatment plans. Maybe A isn't in every one of your patients. Maybe zinc isn't in every one of your patients, but certainly the other supplements would be in there. So just take a review. Think about your most vulnerable patients and just reevaluate what's in their treatment plan. It's a good teaching moment for patients, get them reengaged in their self-care. Now, for the rest of this time, I just want to talk a little bit about modern Chinese medicine and just want to reiterate how much information is coming out of China right now, which is really good information. These are published papers. And what's been done in different hospitals, which herb formulas. And then there is one of my colleagues, Michael McCulloch, and he is up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and he has two amazing free webinars that you can see on the Mayway Herb site. It's maywa.com, Mayway. And he has presented a distillation of all this research that's come out of China and their use of herbs. And if you're interested in that he's really an expert. All right. So remember, of course, our polysaccharides and beta-glucans that primarily come from Chinese medicinal mushrooms and astragalus root. Beta-glucans are just a type of polysaccharide. Those are the ones most common in the medicinal mushrooms. And I just put one slide in here to remind you that the medicinal mushrooms, the beta-glucans and polysaccharides have a profound effect on immune cell populations and immune cell function. And they do have the capacity to make autoimmune disease worse. And so that means we have to think about making cytokine storm worse also. In a skilled herbalist, you could use small amounts in right proportions to other things. And I think ultimately I would like to have a little bit of Ganoderma or astragalus in my formulas for very, very immune compromised patients. But we have to learn more about this syndrome, I think. So there's this wonderful paper here also published in 2019, beta glucan supplement or drug. And those are as data from clinical trials there. And then I just want to show you the main Chinese herbs that I think about using in a situation like this. And then I've given you some references, but I just want you to look at these and recognize them as very important in the viral setting. So my favorite two Chinese herbs as antivirals are isatis and andrographis. Metagenics makes a great formula called andrographis plus. It's a fantastic formula. It's sold out right now, but I have a case in my office. So if you need some for your patients, we can ship it to them. But every supplier is out of stock of everything right now. Isatis is a marvelous antiviral, and the Health Concerns formulas, Astrisatis and Isatis Gold, and Isatis Cooling are wonderful Isatis-based formulas. So these are two very, very powerful antivirals. They're very bitter, and I use them in all types of viral syndromes. And you can think about, cancers that are have viral component to them, like some of the lymphomas, for example. Now, Scutellaria bicolensis, Huang Qin, this is in many, many, many of our anti-tumor formulas. It's rich in berberine, which is a isoquinoline alkaloid, and two important polyphenols, bicalin and bicaline. And there have been studies on these polyphenols and viral impact, and particularly coronaviruses. And so the Scutellaria is not only antiviral, but has good inflammation control and good quenching of oxidative stress. But there are some studies about coronaviruses and Scutellaria that have come out. I also like to use American ginseng, Panax quinquefolium. The ginsenosides in that are very important in fatigue. Chinese medicine tells us that this particular form of ginseng is most important for lung support, and also helps with the risk factors of hypercoagulation and damage to the myocardium and inflammation control. So I like to put that into formulas. It's not going to ramp up a cytokine storm, but it will give a lot of protection and support. And astragalus is definitely on the list of important botanicals. I just want to put the caution red flag about its potential to ramp up autoimmune cytokine activity. But it's one of the most important lung and immune nerves in the Chinese materia medica. It's mildly anti-inflammatory, and it definitely quenches oxidative stress, but it also inhibits viral replication. So it has a place in this setting. And on slide 39, I have put a number of references that I think speak to the gifts of these herbs and some of the research on their viral activity. Now, I just want to point out a handful of formulas that were in the original treatment slides that I gave you, so that you have some familiarity with them and you could perhaps feel comfortable using them. They're all from Health Concerns, and it's American Herbal Company. And very high quality, very clean herbs, very intelligent formulas, either replications of traditional Chinese formulas or modern Chinese herbal formulas. So tremella and ginseng, tremella is a Chinese mushroom. Tremella and ginseng, this uses the American ginseng and astragalus. And then it has a lot of antiviral herbs in it, and it has tonics for kidney qi and digestive qi, spleen qi, and lots of anti-inflammatories. So I really like this formula. This is a formula you can take long-term. It's meant as a tonic. This is the person more yin deficient, more dry, more depleted. Astra-Isatis is another formula you can think of in the prevention niche. It's got the astragalus and the isatis in it. So the astragalus being an immune tonic, lung tonic, the isatis being a potent antiviral, but it also has a lot more support for the liver and for the lungs. It's got ban lung gun in it, which is a main lung qi, lung moistening herb. And it has a little codenopsis in it, which is another Chinese medicinal mushroom, but it has a little bit more yang to it. And so it's for the more cold kind of person who still maybe has phlegm in their chest. So these are two really good formulas, quite safe for long-term use to make a person more robust and more resistant to virus. Now, another formula that I use a lot is Clear Heat formula. And this is a classic antiviral formula for patients who have phlegm in their lungs and a lot of heat and fever and are very depleted. And so I really love this formula. The isatis is the main herb in it, but you'll see that there's andrographis in here, and then you have viola and prunella and lonicera for antivirals. They're very cooling. And so this is a really nice formula. It's also, you can take this formula for a long time. Some of the clear heat type of formulas you can't take for a long time, but this one is okay. So you can, that's during an infection, okay? You take the clear heat when somebody has an infection. And then for these very depleted patients who come out the other side, this enhanced formula, I think, is a brilliant formula. It was actually developed decades ago by my colleague and friend, Dr. Misha Cohen, during the HIV epidemic. But it really is a broad-spectrum tonic with a lot of antivirals and immune herbs in it. And again, it's very balanced. You could take it for a long period of time. It definitely enhances immunity, balances the adaptive and innate immune responses, has antivirals, has anti-inflammatories in it, but lots of tonics as well. And so I like that formula for long-term use for somebody who's come out the other side very depleted and damaged. And then for those patients who have a lot of lung fibrosis and a lot of lung dryness, this traditional formula, lily bulb formula, the traditional name is Baihegunjinwan. You will find lily bulb in the health concerns product line, but you will find Baihegunjinwan in almost all the Chinese formulas, Chinese companies that make modern formulas. It's a very, very widely used formula for dryness and deficiency in the lungs. So for those patients who really have had their lungs essentially burned by cytokines and damaged and scarred and fibrotic, there are a lot of herbs that are also anti-fibrotic. And so I hope to create a supplement and a, you know, more thorough lecture. But for a clinical pearl, that's sort of my overview of things you could think about, ways to think about it, and I think main elements of a plan for these patients. So I will pause, and if anyone would like to unmute themselves and ask a question or make a comment or share their experience, now's the time to do it. Okay, nobody wants to unmute themselves. Remember, star 7. All right, so I am going to go on to the questions that were, oh, somebody wants to
I have
to
a quick question.
Yes, go ahead.
In case someone is severely sick and they're actually intubated, obviously they will not be able to take any of these Chinese herbs orally. So would that be NG tube feeding or?
We have no business treating patients in the ICU.
Okay, got it. This is just prevention.
This is just somebody that's at home, right? Somebody's at home.
Got it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, someone who's intubated is on their way to severe complications. They're extremely compromised. Nobody's going to let you in the ICU to give them anything anyway. So this is for patients at home.
Okay, thanks very much.
But I will say, if cancer patients have feeding tubes, you know, these patients don't have feeding tubes, but you can put herbs in a feeding tube. But a patient in the ICU, nobody will let you bring anything in there anyway, and these patients are in isolation. So we can help them when they're not in the hospital here. In China, patients in the hospital had herbal medicine concurrently. And actually, there's one hospital, Kaiser, in Northern California in the East Bay. My friend, Dr. Michael McCulloch, he developed a Chinese medicine program inside of the Kaiser Hospital in Oakland. And acupuncturists and herbalists are allowed to practice alongside the medical doctors with our medicine in that hospital because of Michael McCulloch. So, we, you know, it's a model for the future, hopefully. All right, let me get
Nalini,
yeah.
Real quickly.
Kaiser.
So that's fascinating about
yes,
Kaiser in
is.
Oakland. And are they documenting? Are they using
Oh, yeah,
herbs?
Michael did his PhD on the program he created there.
But are they doing that? So I'm assuming they're doing that now.
Well, I don't know what they're doing now. You could ask Michael.
Uh-huh.
But if you if you haven't seen his webinars, they're amazing. They're totally his hard science. He's an epidemiologist. He's not only a Chinese medicine doctor. He's an epidemiologist and a master in public health. So his information is stellar. All right. Anything else? Okay, no. All right, so let me just go through the questions that came through. So Jacqueline Tolentino, she asks about elderberry and supplements and herbs to support immunity and my thoughts about Stephen Buhner's coronavirus tinctures. Okay, so there's been a lot of hullabaloo about elderberry creating cytokine storms. This is the problem with the internet. There was one paper published in 2001 that said elderberry can create cytokine overdrive. And then it went all over the internet and people got all upset about it. Elderberry, number one, is a fairly mild herb in the Materia Medica. It's a Western herb. And it is a very useful antiviral. It is always used in skillful herbal medicine in combination with other herbs and formulas. You will see elderberry syrup and things like that. But just in, as far as it goes in the spectrum of antivirals, it's fairly mild. There are many herbs that we think of to use in infections, echinacea, for example, that upregulate the immune response and therefore upregulate cytokines. So we need to know which those are. So some of those I put in a slide to take out, right? I didn't put elderberry on that slide because I don't use it in this context. So I think number one, if you're looking for antivirals, you have much better choices than elderberry, where that's not an issue. So I like Isatis and I like Andrographis much better as antivirals. In a lot of the over-the-counter herbal formulas that you find and traditional herbalism in North America, you will see cold and flu formulas with elderberry, but they're usually part of a larger formula, and so the amount of elderberry wouldn't be a huge amount. But so I'm not worried about elderberry. That's my answer to the question. But what we do want to think about is what herbs upregulate cytokines and which patients are at risk for having a cytokine storm. And so you just have to think about the patient in front of you and what you want to use in that patient. And so if you're looking for antivirals, I just think there's much better things to use than elderberry. But if a patient came in and told you they took elderberry, I wouldn't worry about it. And again, you have to take a really high dose to get into trouble. So it's not something I'm worried about. But I think it brings to our attention the unique capacity of this virus to upregulate inflammation, and that we have to be thoughtful about our treatment plans because of that. Jacqueline asks, what are the most powerful supplements and herbs to support innate immunity? Can you outline the top five? I think I did that in the clinical pearl, so I'm going to just answer the question that way. Now, my thoughts about Stephen Buhner's coronavirus tincture. So I never heard of him before you asked me this question, Jacqueline, so I went and found his paper, and it's 9 pages. I glanced over it. I didn't read the whole thing in detail. But my impression is, number one, he's very knowledgeable. Number two, he's been reviewing this information that's come out of China. That's what that looks like to me, a lot of what he has there. And then he may also be following the work of Peter Diadamo, who has a blog and a website that, and Peter is just like a genius. He is a naturopath, but he's also a computer programmer. And he has a site called DataPunk, DataPunk, where he has all his algorithms and his charts and all of this. So Michael McCullough got all the herbs that were primarily being used in China, and then he sorted them by herbs in those lists that we can get in America. And then he sorted that list to herbs that are known to be active against coronaviruses. And so that's how you have to think about this, right? And so Peter Diadamo has some of those on his website. And there was also a webinar by Designs for Health where Peter Diadamo, Todd Lepine, and David Brady talked about some of these other supplements. They talked also extensively about quercetin and nettle root. And nettle leaf, And those are on my list. They talked about N-acetylcysteine. Todd talked about some other anti-inflammatories we could think about. I mean, we have a big materia medica. The things that are readily available already in our cancer patients, protocols with the Alpchart Cancer System, just use those because we're already covering a lot of bases. So my answer to your question, Jacqueline, is I think Steven Buhner looks like he knows what he's talking about, done his homework, and all of the things that were in his paper are being discussed in the context of which herbs affect the ACE2 receptors and where the virus binds and which herbs have activity against this family of viruses, etc. But I didn't see a thoughtful discussion of how you manage a patient. So it's one thing to know about herbs and their properties, but it's a whole nother thing to know how to safely manage a patient. So I don't know him, but it looks like his information is very sound. So that's my answer to your question. I don't know him at all. I've never heard him lecture. I don't know how he works with patients. But my emphasis in this context is how do we make good decisions about patient care when we have knowledge of herbs and supplements? So did you want to have any further discussions on that? If you do, you can unmute yourself.
Hi, Nalini. It's Jacqueline. Just wanted to thank you.
Oh, okay. You're welcome. All right. And thank you for bringing his work to my attention because I didn't know about him. All right. So next is Jennifer Gianti. She asks, what are your thoughts on elevated M protein tumor markers for multiple myeloma patients with no physical symptoms? Patients feeling great, but her markers are slightly elevating. So these are patients that are called smoldering patients, you know, in the hematologic cancers, where the oncologist doesn't necessarily want to do anything but wait and watch and monitor the patient and wait to treat till later. Now, in some hematologic cancers, including multiple myeloma, that has been the approach in conventional oncology for a long time. There have been some studies to show that earlier intervention increases survival and exerts more control over the disease. But I think, again, you know, our model is to look at each individual. And because we can intervene with our materia medica, then I'd like that to be the intervention first before they start using drugs with toxicity. So that's my approach. If I have a patient with a smoldering hematologic cancer where the oncologist wants to wait and watch, then I jump in with a protocol. So that is what I would encourage you to do because it's not normal to have M proteins. That is a sign of disease activity. And the other problem with the proteins in these types of cancers is they're big molecules and they chew up the nephrons and they cause kidney damage. And so you also have to monitor kidney function in these patients, and you also have to monitor coagulation factors in these patients. And in multiple myeloma, you have to monitor and support bone health because multiple myeloma invades the bone, and people can have fractures. And so you want to be cognizant of all of those aspects of the patient's health and well-being and physiology. So in multiple myeloma, I use vitamin A and vitamin D. I monitor the coagulation factors. And a lot of these patients have hypercoagulation because they're on treatment, like Revlimid, for example, is a common treatment. But even so, because of the abnormal profile of their blood cells, you just want to watch them carefully. And then you want to support their bones. So I like Osteoben a lot for these patients because multiple myeloma invades the bones. You could think about using Osteoforce by Designs for Health, which has a little copper in it, because it's really solid tumors that utilize copper the most, and a little copper might help the bones. But I pretty much use the Osteoben formula as a bone health formula because it's copper-free. free. And just to go back to the hypercoagulation, if you are using omega-3 fatty acids and curcumin in your protocol, then you're going to oppose hypercoagulation in a mild way. And my favorite botanical for hypercoagulation is Danshan, Chinese red sage root, salvia, miltiriza. You could consider that. And then there are a lot of modern Chinese formulas for multiple myeloma today in China, and that's the first line treatment in China today. And so I just gave you an example of the herbs that are in those formulas that you could look at and think about, and you know, even go talk to a Chinese herbalist or have our clinic mix something for your patient if they're so interested. And then just a sidebar, I use nettle seed extract to protect the kidneys in patients who whose kidneys have been damaged either by their cancer or by chemotherapy. And then we could think about the COVID-19 survivors also who have had damage to their nephrons. So milk thistle is really useful when the damage to the nephron has been from oxidative stress. So that's not what's causing it in multiple myeloma. It's these big light chain molecules that just tear up the nephrons. So that is my kind of overview of how to think about this patient in the early stages. I don't see that you're on the call. So if you have questions, you can let me know. But that's a way to get started with multiple myeloma. Then Susie Thompson has a question. She states, we want to reduce iron intake in cancer, but we tell patients to eat lots of leafy greens. Is there a good study that refers that we could refer to explain why heme iron is contraindicated, but non-heme iron foods are okay? So first, I have to say, iron metabolism is not my area of expertise, so I'm going to answer this simply. So non-heme iron is primarily found in plants, but it's not found in huge amounts, and it is not linked to some of the problems that heme iron causes in physiology. Heme iron is primarily found in animal sourced iron, and it's what we have in our bodies also. And the heme iron tends to be in higher milligram amounts in foods as well, and so the iron levels go up higher when you eat animal-based iron products. And iron overall is a pro-oxidant, and so it damages tissue and damages DNA, damages the lining of the blood vessels. And so it is problematic for all those reasons. And it is linked to an increase in cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, the heme iron, whereas non-heme iron is not linked to those things. It may be the way it's bound. It may be the concentration of iron, not my area of expertise, just my conjecture. But I did a PubMed search and put in heme iron and oxidative stress, and over 100 references came up. So somebody else can become the expert on heme and non-heme iron and report to us. But that's sort of my general overview. So if you're wanting to have a patient be on an iron-restricted diet and the source of iron is just vegetables, their iron intake isn't going to be super high. Of course, beet greens are very high in iron. And after that, spinach, they don't want those to be the only vegetables someone is eating on an iron-restricted diet. But generally, we don't worry about the non-heme iron because of that, at least that empirical data, I'm sure there's an expert would have a better answer to your question. All right. The second question that Susie asked is, when a cancer cell metastasizes, it enters a lymph node and uses fat as fuel. What do we do with the diet of someone with metastatic cancer? I advise low glycemic, kind of adapted keto diets, and now I'm not sure what to do, meaning the diet is higher in fat that she recommends, as we do. So she gave a reference. So I looked at the reference paper, and here's my answer. Number one, there's just not enough data on all of this to really thoroughly answer this question, but this is my answer from an understanding of cancer physiology and the behavior of tumor cells. So
lymph nodes are lipid-rich environments. They're not very vascular environments, so there's not a lot of blood flow in there. And so the environment inside a lymph node is fairly hypoxic, which forces the cancer cell to figure out what to do to survive. So most cancer cells will revert to glycolysis, which is what cells do when they're in hypoxic environments. Some cancer cells will revert to lipolysis. But remember, the electron transport chain still requires oxygen. And so you're not going to get a big fatty acid metabolism going on in a little tiny lymph node with a few cells in it. And we could argue that just the hypoxic environment is going to constrain the behavior of tumor cells in the lymph node anyway. So the answer is, that's my hypothesis and my observation also, that patients on ketogenic diets have less disease progression because most tumor cells are relying upon glycolysis, not lipolysis. But at any given time in any person's body, no matter what diet they're on, a cancer cell can use the electron transport chain. It can use glycolysis and can use glutaminolysis. It can use lipolysis. And the more adaptable, smart cancer cells will figure out how to survive in the environment they're in. Are we going to promote lymph node metastasis with a ketogenic diet? I don't think so. Evidence doesn't show us that, but there's no study to support my statement. That's just my observation. So that is my answer to that question. Does anybody want to make a comment on any of those things? That it is 6:30. We've gone an hour. I have two case studies to go through, and that'll probably take us another 20, 30 minutes. So does anyone want to comment on any of my answers to these questions? Okay, I'm going to jump in. So Judy Pazinski submitted a case. This is a 71-year-old female Caucasian woman who is short and plump and wants to live a long, healthy life, but doesn't want it to be filled with doctor's visits and treatments, and feels that there aren't a lot of treatments that are really helping, and her statistics look good. How should we proceed? So she had... Her diagnostics are, she had an excisional biopsy, it was positive for breast cancer. It turns out she had multifocal breast cancer, more than one lesion, invasive mucinous carcinoma, and grade 2, and a modified Bloom-Richardson score of 6. She also had DCIS and extensive intraductal cells, and she had surgery. And her surgeon's concern, oncologist's concern, were that the margins were very narrow around the surgical incisions, only 5 millimeters, and there was some focal necrosis. And so one of Judy's questions is, well, should they go back in and get cleaner margins, or should they just go ahead with the radiation that the physician is proposing? So here's the thing with her, just her picture, she's got cells all over the place. So the surgery just got the masses, but she has diffuse disease in her breast. So surgery isn't a final solution for her. And because she has the DCIS and she had more than one lesion, so you know there's other cells all over the place. And so surgery is not the ultimate solution for her anyway. A second surgery has more risk than the radiation. And so, again, it's like a risk versus benefit question. She would still be recommended radiation. So because her disease is diffuse, it's also, as I recall, on her right side. And so we're not going to put the heart in danger because it's not the left breast. I believe I'm correct in that. And her oncotype of both of the tumor masses, her oncotype scores were low, showing there isn't much benefit to chemotherapy, even though she's hormone receptor positive for both estrogen and progesterone and HER2 negative. So her treatment, you know, remember, the first job when you get diagnosed is reduce your tumor mass. So the question is, how are you going to do that? So if you have something operable and it's safe to operate, you take that option, and then you've reduced a lot of the tumor mass. But here we have someone with diffuse disease. So what are we going to do about that? Radiation is a insurance policy, and it's very hard to argue against statistics with a picture like this. I don't think it'd be in her best interest to decline radiation. Radiation is finite. And the other cool thing about radiation is the die-off of the tumor cells from radiotherapy produces an immune response, which you could think of like a vaccine against your own cells. So you get a systemic immune response when you do radiotherapy. So that's a positive aspect of radiotherapy. And so whatever the surgery didn't get, the radiation will get most of what's left. And then she's going to go on some kind of, or she is on aromatase inhibitors because due to the COVID situation, she isn't having radiation right now. And so I concur with the oncologist's recommendations for her. And plus, her course of radiotherapy is incredibly conservative. It's only 15 treatments. So she's only having 3 weeks of treatment. So that's not very much. Most patients get 5 or 6 weeks of radiotherapy. So you can present it to her that way. And this positive aspect of getting a systemic inoculation to your own tumor cells, so that whatever's left from all of this, the immune system's been educated to go after those cells. So a person like this, especially at her age, I think she would weather that okay. And then, you know, we do our job to make her robust and healthy and manage the tumor microenvironment and her whatever side effects she has from the aromatase inhibitors, make sure she has a bone density and you watch her bone metabolism. I would check, you know, bone density scan, a DEXA scan, and also do an NTX on her to see the bone breakdown products in the urine so that if that increases, you can, you know, be more aggressive with her therapy for bone health. So I looked at your protocol. I have a couple of things I would add to it. One is I'd add some carnitine, either carnitine tartrate or in a powder if she does a shake, or L-carnitine in a capsule for her, about 1.5 to 2 grams a day for muscle mass and bone mass and mitochondrial function and fatigue. I think that would be nice to add to your protocol. And otherwise, I really like the treatment plan you put together. And I just sort of put in that I like the Designs for Health Resveratrol Supreme because it also has quercetin in it. And I like it for that reason, for your choice of a resveratrol. And then you asked about the Osteoband because it has genistein in it. So genistein does not drive estrogen receptor positive cancers. And so I'm not worried about it. And what's really interesting, remember, a lot of molecules are pleomorphic and multitaskers. And genistein is also an aromatase inhibitor. And it also primarily binds to the estrogen receptors in the bone and the brain and not in the breast and the reproductive organs. So genistein can actually be therapeutic for a patient like this. It doesn't create risk. So I don't really like the osteophores because it has the copper in it, which I think is more of a problem in a cancer that can metastasize. So I would rather she use the Osteoben, and I'm not worried about the genistein. So I think that answers your question on that. And then the medical doctor said no high dosing of vitamins A, C, and E while on radiation. So what we know is that the nutraceutical antioxidants like A, C, and E have the potential to interfere with radiotherapy. The amount of AC&E in a multivitamin is not problematic. The amount of AC&E in regular healthy diet is not problematic. But adding capsules of these additionally can interfere with radiotherapy. So I don't do that. We also know that the phytochemicals, the antioxidant phytochemicals in herbs and food don't interfere and are often synergistic with radiotherapy. So we don't have to worry about things like resveratrol and curcumin and things like that. So I just pull out the nutraceutical antioxidants being given extra above a multivitamin. So that's how I handle that. And it's for a very finite period of time. And then what would be a valid option? Would it be a valid option to have another surgery? I believe I answered that question. It's always a surgeon's call, but I don't think a surgeon would go in there because surgery is not the main solution. It's a partial solution. And so a person 71 years old shouldn't be having another surgery that isn't going to give them a huge benefit. And nobody's going to do surgery on her right now anyway, because all surgeries are canceled for the most part, unless they're urgent. The other thing I was thinking about for your patient, if you're not already doing this, is like some kind of a nice spleen qi tonic for her, like maybe Six Gentlemen or Bujangi Qitan, something like that. And then I also wrote you a formula that you could do something with more anti-tumor activity that also has some spleen qi support in it and some aromatase support in it. And so that I put in Scutellaria bicolensis and Scutellaria barbata, which are really great for breast cancer. And I put in Oldelandia and curcuma and camellia, which is green tea, and also Taxus. I put in Taxus brevifolia tips, which is, you know, taxane, great for breast cancer. And I put in a little bit of urtica dioica root, which is nettle root, which is also an aromatase inhibitor. And then I put in some chen pea, some tangerine, dried tangerine peel, and some dried ginger just for spleen qi and digestive function, and a little bit of licorice root. And that'll be, and then there's astragalus and ganoderma in there for her immunity too. So I think that's a nice formula. She could take that, you know, like, she could take it maybe 2 weeks out of every month for a long time, something like that, 1 or 2 teaspoons a day. So did you want to discuss that further, Judy?
Two quick ones. So just because she said she was concerned that resveratrol was bad for hormone-positive breast cancer, and I had always thought that resveratrol was good for it. So you're just definitively saying, yeah, not to worry.
I'm not worried about resveratrol, and I'm not worried about genistein. They both actually have aromatase inhibition.
That's right. Great. Yeah. And then real quickly, for the radiation burn, she's got very big breasts, and I'm concerned about, particularly underneath, that could just be nasty.
Yeah. So I just really think the best thing is fresh aloe vera. So you get a plant, right? And show her how to scoop the gel out. And you can, you know, take a leaf, cut it off the plant, and then scoop out a little bit, put it on a 4x4 gauze, and then put that on top of the skin. I think that's the best thing. And also Herb Farm makes a really nice calendula oil. And that's really nice. So you just saturate a 4x4 gauze and put it on the affected areas like that.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah. That's what I usually do. But there's nothing like the fresh aloe vera. Nothing like it. So, all right. So we have Jennifer. Did you have something?
Yes, I do have a quick question, Dr. Lenini. Thank you so much for this case. Thank you, Judy. I have a similar patient. I have a patient with similar situation with Judy. My question is, I really like the custom tonic that you created for her. Mm-hmm. But my patient has elevated liver enzymes. Will this be good for a patient with, you know, elevated AST and ALT?
Well, I wouldn't want to give a formula like this to someone who we didn't do a thorough workup, you know, look at the whole picture. In my experience, no, I don't think this formula would be problematic. Might take the green tea out, you know. But no, I don't think it would be problematic.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, if you're worried about any supplement because someone has liver function abnormalities, then start at low doses and monitor them. But I always take the green tea out of those patients. And
okay,
then we might want to put in milk thistle, you know, things like that, you know.
Awesome. And this wouldn't be good for daily? Has to be 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off?
you can, I actually, some of my patients who have higher risk for recurrence, I would give it every day, you know.
Okay,
but
great.
I don't think this woman has a really high risk of recurrence from the
okay, great.
I have. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, I have one more case study from Susie Thompson. And this is from a 21-year-old young man, a European young man, who she says is an ectomorph. And he has non-Hodgkin's lymphoma stage 2. And his physician has him on an incredibly aggressive chemotherapy. It's called BECOP, B-E-A-C-O-P-P. Bleomycin, etoposide, doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide, vincristine, tocarbazine, and prednisone. So that's rough. That's really rough. But it has a 91% survival rate, and this is a 21-year-old. He probably would stand it. And so I would say for a young person like this is to just help him get through the treatment and then afterwards help them recover from the side effects and, you know, teach him how to change his lifestyle and develop good self-care skills so that he can be healthy for the rest of his life. Hodgkin's lymphomas don't, wait, is this Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's? Hold on. Hold on. Yeah, this Hodgkin's lymphoma. So Hodgkin's lymphomas really recur if you get it right. So this kid also asked if he could have alcohol during his treatment. So, you know, it's an opportunity for patient teaching when someone is young to help them think about what causes health and to help them go on a learning curve and really think about their choices. Because at 21, he might have a little wildness left in him. And so we want him to go forward in his life and not injure himself and not increase his risk of other problems. So I think it's just when you get someone that age and you're not the parent, you have an opportunity to really talk to them about what shape do they want their life to look like after this is over, and what as an adult do they want to choose for themselves going forward. And I would inquire into his lifestyle, his recreational drug use, his, you know, healthy or unhealthy relationship to himself and his health, so that this is a developmental gateway for him as he forms himself as a young adult. And certainly going through this will transform him, but we want that to be a positive experience for him. And so we want to give him the tools to frame this in a way that this can be a growth experience and not just something negative. So I think with a young person like this, we have the opportunity to really give them a way to frame it that's very, very positive and transformative and healing, and to acknowledge how hard it's going to be to go through this kind of chemo, and to tell him that we have a toolbox for managing side effects so that he can do better. We have a plan to support his health. So Susie's very experienced and she has a good plan in place for him. So I'm just going to make some comments. Number one, Susie, my input to you on the information sheet you provided to your patient, it's really great, but I would say to really be careful how much medical data you give to the patient. Now, I don't know if this young man is a scientist or was in medical school. I don't know who he is. But I just want to caution you not to overwhelm the lay person with a lot of medical information that doesn't apply to them. So I would filter this and make sure that what you say to the patient applies to them, and to ask yourself, is this information important at this stage of his journey? Like all the risk factors that contribute to this, because he already has the disease and he's young, he's overwhelmed. Would this conversation be better at the other end when he's done with treatment, where you're teaching him how to be healthy and reduce risk factors? So I just want to be mindful of overwhelm and presenting patients with lingo that is medical lingo that they might not understand, and for giving them all the kind of negatives, all the risk factors, all the dangerous things. I would like to give a patient more hope and communicate to them. We have tools to get you through this and have a good outcome, and we'll teach you how to be healthy on the other side, and maybe have this discussion with them on the other side when they're through it and they have no evidence of disease, which is where this young man should land after this. But he will have side effects. I'm a little concerned about the bleomycin, which can permanently damage the lungs. I would also encourage you to just stop the curcumin, resveratrol, green tea, indole 3 carbinolin, DIM, fucoidin, forskolin, and CoQ10 during this. You could keep the quercetin in there, but he's on so many drugs and we just don't know enough about all the drug interactions. You can keep the vitamin D in there as well, but we want this guy to have the best outcome. It's his potential is to go through this really aggressive treatment, come out the other side, and never have cancer again. So that the plan is to help him do that. We want to watch for hypercoagulation, monitor his D-dimer and fibrinogen. He's on a weekly cycle, so with so many drugs, let's say the duration of action is going to go through day 5, and then you have like days 6 and 7 to do a little detox with something like Designs for Health Detox Antioxidant, which has milk thistle and acetylcysteine and a few other antioxidants in it. And then I'd give him some extra milk thistle because he's going to need to care for his liver with this, which is also the reason he shouldn't be drinking. But you want to teach him that alcohol is a carcinogen and alcohol is hepatotoxic. And so to get him to start thinking about how he's going to make decisions on his own, like what information, how should he think about when he wants to do something, given his vulnerabilities. I would also add some glutamine to repair the lining of his GI tract and some astragalus to support his white cells and also some meroplast so that his blood cells don't crash. And then I would expect him to get some neuropathy as well. So I'd put some acetyl L-carnitine in there. The glutamine will also speak to that. And bone broth for minerals and collagen and repair of the lining of the GI tract. And for another source of protein, remember every cup of bone broth has 10 grams of protein in it. You also ask about how to convince his physicians that supplements won't interfere with his treatment. So, you know, nobody's going to persuade you or me to practice differently. So you're not going to persuade an oncologist to practice differently. But what you can do is build relationships with physicians so that they know who you are, they know your knowledge base, they know that you have the skills and the clinical good judgment not to interfere with his treatment. And indeed, there are many things that could interfere with his treatment. And so we should be very conservative. And that's why I recommended taking out some of the things that you had recommended to him. And then we're just going to, what I'd focus on right now is foundation nutrients. And I'll go through the list I recommend. I'd focus on the foundation nutrients, make sure he's replete in his basic nutrition and speak to his higher nutrient needs right now. And then try to manage the adverse effects. And then when he's done with this chemo, then there's more that we can do. And then you want to put a plan for the next phase where we use more of our toolbox in there. But remember, he's a 21-year-old, so you have to see what he's willing to do also and what he can afford to do. So I would put a good multi in there. I like the Integrative Therapeutic ProThriver Wellness Multi. I also like the twice daily by Designs for Health, just like a basic multi that's copper free and iron free. The Designs for Health Vitamin D Supreme I like because it has the K in it, a good probiotic. I like Claire Therabiotic Complete. All these patients need more magnesium, so I'd give them extra magnesium glycinate and some omega-3s. None of those are going to interfere with his treatment. And then to take out the other supplements, just because we don't know enough about drug interactions with a aggressive cocktail like that. Now, Susie's not on the call, so we won't have any interaction with her. So we've gone 90 minutes almost. I thank you all for your attention. I'm happy to open this up to any questions or concerns or discussion. and you can unmute yourself if you want to share anything or ask anything.
Hi, Melanie.
Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, are you taking...
Melanie, thank you so much for 3 years. Oops, sorry.
I'll be back. I'm
going to end
with sabbatical.
I was going to conclude with thanks.
Yeah, I was just wondering, are you still taking appointments even though you're on a sabbatical?
Oh, I'm just taking a sabbatical from the course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
I'm doing telemedicine right now. And so, yeah, I'm not taking a sabbatical from my private practice. I want to rethink how we're doing the course. I think we need to update some things. I think there's some holes in the curriculum, and I want to find another way to deliver the information. And so I just need to step back from it. I've had my nose on it for 5 years, and I think I need some perspective. And so that's why I also welcome input and feedback from everyone to what you like, what you don't like, what needs to be updated, what information is missing you feel you need to serve your patients. I'm going to be thinking about that. I also have an enormous number of lectures that I've done at conferences that I can turn into modules for this course and add those. So I just need some time to do that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I'll miss being with all of you once a month, but we'll figure out what the next incarnation is. All right, everyone. Thank you for being part of this wonderful community and for your attention and participation and for being of service to so many people. And we'll circle back. Good night.